from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. International police attempting to investigate the Malaysian Airlines crash site yesterday were forced for a second day to retreat in the face of fierce fighting between pro-Russian rebels and Ukraine's military. Meanwhile, the United States and Europe said they would adopt the toughest sanctions yet on Russia this week. And earlier today, at a news conference with the Ukrainian foreign minister, United States Secretary of State John Kerry talked about those sanctions, warning of further economic measures against Russia if it refuses to put pressure on pro-Russian separatists to allow access to the site.
President Putin can make a huge difference here if he chooses to. And we and our European partners will take additional measures and impose wider sanctions on key sections of the Russian economy if that is what we must do.
And also yesterday, the Obama administration accused Russian President Putin in a letter that Russia broke a 1987 nuclear treaty by testing a cruise missile. Experts join us in this segment of Forum to discuss these developments and more. Joining us in studio is Catherine Stoner. She is senior fellow at the Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University, and we welcome her to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also mentioned political scientist and senior fellow. We also have Angela Stent with us, professor of government, director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University. She served as an advisor on Russia under Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, and she's the author of The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. Joins us from Nantucket. Welcome, Angela Stent. Good to have you back on Forum.
Thank you. Great to be back.
Catherine Stoner, let me begin with you, and let's talk about the sanctions and see. I mean, these are stronger sanctions from the EU on trade, banking, and high-tech and energy sectors. And this, I should mention, adds to the existing freeze on travel ban and on a list of, shall we say, people who are linked to the Kremlin. What kind of effect, though, is this likely to have? I mean, whenever sanctions come across, there's hope that it will they'll have teeth to them, but historically, you know what the story is.
Right. Sanctions are generally a blunt instrument in international politics. That said, I think actually the sanctions the U.S. put on most recently, their third round of sanctions the day before the MH17 plane went down, were very significant and had a, you know, could have a very strong effect on Russia's already ailing economy. I think it's very significant also what the our European partners have moved to do today, which is far more than they've done in the past and much closer to what the U.S. did a few weeks ago. So I think this will begin to have some pretty major effects on the Russian economy, which, as I mentioned, is already suffering. It's had $75 billion in capital flight so far in the first 6 months of this year.
But Angela Stent, maybe the economy, but questionable about what kind of political effect it would have on Putin, and particularly in terms of destabilizing. It seems to be ongoing efforts to destabilize Ukraine.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree completely with Catherine that these really sanctions do have economic teeth. The Europeans have done something they haven't done for 22 years, which is to really reconsider their entire economic relationship with Russia. But we know that in the past, these sanctions have not changed what Russia does. And it seems that Mr. Putin right now is in a mood, in a phase where the tougher the sanctions, the more he digs in. Russia has been upping its assistance, military assistance to the separatists, the insurgents in eastern Ukraine, even since the airliner was downed. So I think that we should not expect in the near future that we're going to see any change in Russia's attitude towards finding a solution or ramping this down. In fact, we may see the opposite.
Yeah, we are seeing, Catherine Stoner, more weapons going across the border. What do you think Putin's endgame here is? I mean, he's you know, quite a four-dimensional chess player in terms of maneuvers and everything. A lot of American political analysts from both sides are saying that he's got game a lot more over President Obama. We don't have to necessarily go into that kind of analysis. But what do you think he's out for here?
So I think he's actually out. First of all, I agree with Angela. I mean, the problem, this is first a problem with sanctions and in general anywhere. And second, sanctions take time. And second, a problem in dealing with Mr. Putin. So I think ultimately he fears the street in Russia, and he doesn't want to have any kind of orange revolution.
Still very popular.
Yeah. And so the sanctions could erode that popularity domestically. He's at 83% public approval rating right now, but he controls the media for the most part. You know, if you were there, you might vote for him too. That said, I do think that the end game here, though, is, and since public opinion and approval is so high, is really to keep Ukraine destabilized, not necessarily to own Ukraine and all of its problems, but to make it unattractive to the European Union and therefore not drift further out of Russia's orbit.
And how, Angela Stent, does the recent notification by Putin in a letter on Monday from President Obama that Russia broke the nuclear treaty in 1987 by testing cruise missiles figure into this whole package or this calculus, if you will?
Well, I mean, I think this is just another sign of how bad Russia's relations with the West, and particularly U.S.-Russian relations, are. In fact, Putin has criticized Mr. Gorbachev for signing this intermediate forces agreement with President Reagan in 1987. I mean, we've known for some time that Russia was violating this. The Russians have said for some time that they were reconsidering whether they should still be part of this INF treaty. But what it does is it raises military tension. It once again raises the specter that we had during the Cold War, that here you have the world's two nuclear superpowers and that, you know, their weapons are pointed against each other. And now when we see this ramping up, we see Putin going to Cuba and reopening the signals intelligence facility they have in Lourdes, which they closed down when he came into power. So it's really a ramping up of military tensions and military antagonisms that begin to remind us more and more of what it was like actually before Gorbachev came to power.
Yeah, it does seem like the neo-Cold War that we're in here. But Russia has a kind of, under Putin, plausible deniability. I mean, with arms supplying and with the plane shot down, and it would cost a great deal to Russia economically. I mean, they're getting hurt by the sanctions, as both of you said, but it would cost them a great deal to invade and annex southeast Ukraine, right?
But I don't think that, you know, they don't need to invade southeast Ukraine. I mean, as Catherine says, Putin's aim is to destabilize Ukraine. I would add it's to make it impossible for the new Ukrainian government to function and to exert influence over the territory over which it nominally has control. So, I mean, there are now some rumors that maybe they really are going to invade. I really don't think they need to, because in this kind of gray zone, in this hybrid war where they're able to do whatever they want to do with plausible deniability, they can achieve those goals without sending troops over the border.
And Catherine Stoner, let's talk just a moment about the difficulty of access on the MH17 investigation. I guess Russia just doesn't want international actors dealing with rebels, at least in part. That's what it's all about, isn't it?
And I think Ukraine doesn't either. The Ukrainian government does not want to give the rebel movement any kind of legitimacy. And so dealing with them, a government as though it were a government, is highly problematic. I think the other issue is what's going to happen if we let in international investigators. They're going to find out that the hypothesis that a Buk missile was fired at this airliner is going to be proven correct. The next question is, where did it come from and who fired it? And I don't think it's in Russia's interest to have those questions honestly answered. So why allow access? Why encourage access or make it easy for international investigators?
What about in this neo-Cold War that we're talking about, Angela Stein, what about a more military posture from the West and from the United States? I know NATO's already going to be having troops on military display in Poland in October. Does the United States need to sort of show its strength here in some military way?
Well, I mean, I think unfortunately we're now in a position where, you know, we've imposed sanctions, but we really need to go back to the playbook from the Cold War, which is deterrence. We want to deter Russia from doing any more, from destabilizing any other parts of its neighborhood. The problem is that practically none of our NATO allies, with a few exceptions, are willing to spend even 2% of their GDP on defense. They've all gotten very comfortable with living in this post-Cold War peaceful world. So if we want to have a credible deterrent posture, we're going to have to try and persuade our European allies that they have to put their money where their mouth is, that they have to be prepared to spend more on defense. This isn't really a U.S. problem. It's a problem of our allies and the huge discrepancy between what we spend to keep NATO going and the rest of our NATO allies.
All right, lots to talk about here with Russia, the ongoing crisis with Ukraine, the investigation of MH17, the jet that was shot down presumably by those who are separatists on the Russian side, and also questions about the future of Ukraine and really the future of relations between the United States and Russia and what I'm sort of calling a neo-Cold War here. We welcome your thoughts. We welcome your calls and your emails, and you can join us now. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join the program. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website and posting any questions or comments there. That's kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, talking with Angela Stent, who is professor of government and director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown. She also served as an advisor under Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush, and is the author of The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. And with us in studio, Catherine Stoner, political scientist and senior fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford. We'll bring you our listeners in here. But first, I'm just going to ask you, Catherine Stoner, about the elections coming up in Ukraine. And if you could give us just a kind of brief thumbnail sketch. I think you're calling them paramilitary elections.
Well, there are parliamentary elections coming up in Ukraine. We, of course, have the election of a new president April, and so now the parliament has to go through elections because the prime minister resigned, the interim prime minister resigned. And he resigned basically over problems related to the war and moving on with policy questions that have to be resolved, particularly related to the economy. One thing I wanted to raise, though, Michael, was whether or not this is a neo-Cold War. And I don't think we can call it that, because Russia is not a superpower anymore.
She thinks she is.
Right.
Or now, she wants to appear as one.
So I'm actually starting a book on this, on why Russia's not a superpower anymore and why this isn't a Cold War. And it's called Imperial Dreams, because I think what Mr. Putin is trying to do is not reconstitute the Soviet Union, which was a very specific political and economic system, but actually to reestablish Russia as a great power. And there's a big difference there. There's no ideology. He has no ideology here. There's no communism.
Didn't they say, though, that the greatest tragedy of the 20th century was the breakdown of the Soviet Union, or the USSR? I mean,
he means
that's
it
pretty strong language to use when we think about the tragedies of the 20th century.
He means it as a geographic entity and as an empire. He doesn't mean it in terms of communist ideology and the planned economy and in that sense. Yeah, he really means what...
When you have a nuclear power of that status with those kinds of armaments... Are we not, and despite Russia being weaker, and obviously it's weaker.
Mm-hmm. Much weaker.
Well, Angela Stent, let's have you weigh in here, please.
Well, I mean, okay, it's not capitalism versus communism, but there's an increasingly strong ideological element in this, too. Mr. Putin has now put Russia forward as the leader of a global conservative movement. He says that the West is decadent, it's in decline, that its values aren't legitimate, that Russia has a better value system. He appeals to these kind of traditional values, and that's also an appeal to Muslim countries and to Russia's own Islamic population, where there are obviously lots of problems. And so by putting forward this vision of Russia as an alternative to the West and as a superior civilization criticizing what we consider to be our value system, there definitely is an ideological element there. And certainly Putin, I think, increasingly, as someone wrote today in a blog post, that he wants Russia to be seen as the go-to country, you know, for countries who really don't like the United States and resent its global power. So we're not in a Cold War yet, certainly. And, of course, Russia's much weaker than it was before. It's not the U.S.'s strategic rival. But it is increasingly becoming, I would say, an ideological rival, too.
It's also really colored, just from standing out here on the sidelines as I am, by intense nationalism in Russia. And where that nationalism is going to lead, I'm not sure. But when you talk about appealing to Muslim populations, I don't think there's much appeal there to the Chechens where the Russians are concerned. I mean, there are divisions within the Russian Empire, if they're going to be trying to make themselves into some kind of an empire again, that are really quite great. I'm sorry, yeah. Catherine Stoner, you want to say?
Yeah, there are 121 different ethnic nationalities within Russia. But the other thing I was going to say is that He may be asserting this sort of this conservative alternative to the West as an ideology, but who exactly is joining up here? The Taliban's not going to join up. The ISIS is not going to join up. Al-Qaeda is not going to join up. So it's not clear to me who exactly is going to join, other than countries that were former members of the Soviet Union, that he's going to bully into joining this Eurasian Union.
Well, I don't think he's trying to get these. What I was talking about is not about the Eurasian Union. I'm talking about a global appeal. And if you look at public opinion data, I mean, it's not only the BRIC countries, but others. There are a number of countries in the world, that are very cautious of criticizing Russia, to which Russia is appealing. You may have noticed in the recent election to the European Parliament, all of the extreme white nationalist groups, they love Putin. They think Russia is wonderful. And in fact, Russia has all kinds of links with far-right and far-left parties in Europe. So this is a broader appeal globally, again, to kind of relativize what the West stands for, and to have Russia as an alternative model for the rest of the world. And as Mr. Putin said when he was on television just before the Sochi Games began, and someone asked him, this was a ABC program, I think, about the LGBT legislation and things like that. He said 70 countries in the world have similar laws. And then he paused and he said, and in 7 countries they execute people. So it's this kind of appeal to countries in the world that certainly aren't going to support the U.S. and the Europeans.
Well, let me read some of your comments. In fact, speaking of U.S. and Europeans, we're getting a number of comments along those lines, but here's Sean, who says, it seems to be a slight bit of hypocrisy on both the U.S. and Russia. U.S. funds and arms Syrian rebels against Assad, while Russia funds and arms the Ukrainian separatists. Both sides then accuse the other of being wrong for these actions while pretending their actions are justified. And Frank writes, the U.S. has backed neo-Nazi radicals in Ukraine for decades. Today, the tradition has culminated in a coup, but you'd never know about the far-right aspect from watching CNN or Fox or listening to NPR. Sorry, Frank, we've talked about it here. But anyway, let me go to another email from Liz in San Jose, who writes, while back we promised Russia not to expand NATO, and we have expanded it way eastwards. Mr. Putin's a jerk, but one can hardly blame him for being paranoid. Obviously, we're after him. Let me bring in some of your calls, and we'll begin, Brad, with you. Good morning.
Can I just say something on the NATO issue?
Yeah, go ahead.
We never promised the Soviet Union that we wouldn't expand NATO. This is a canard.
Thank you. Brad, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm mainly interested in what's the source of Putin's popularity at home. I mean, I can see these other sort of rogue nations or whatever and anti-U.S. sentiment, but what's the source of his popularity at home? I think of the Russian people as fairly intellectual and interested and engaged, and why would they be supporting him at such high level?
Well, he's a Russian nationalist and he's tough, Catherine Stoner. I mean, that's what comes immediately to my mind. How would you analyze it?
Yeah, so it's interesting because he's been in power really since 2000, and what he did, one of the first things he did when he came into office as president was to use the federal government's licensing abilities with the media to gradually have the state take over the media and to manage the message. So if you are in Russia, most people get their news from television. The television is largely state-controlled. And so the message that you get constantly is that he is doing wonderful things everywhere in the country, from personally putting out forest fires to, discovering amphoras in the Black Sea that were planted for him. But still, we found out later.
Well, like most, shall we say, hegemonic figures, he has a lot of control over the media.
Right. But the big thing is really people have seen in those 14 years a complete change in many parts of Russia in terms of how they live, and a tripling of incomes until 2008 and the global economic bust. But that story may be harder to maintain now with the sanctions against him, when Russia's growth was slowing before as well. So that's really the media control. He appears very competent. He does stand up to foreign leaders. He's trying to reassert Russia as a great power. And then people having seen their lives changing since 2008.
I'd add one other thing, though. You might want to comment on this too, Angela Stent, but he's made alliances with the Russian Orthodox Church. And even though all that atheism was reigning in Russia for so many years, there's appeal, particularly to older citizens of Russia, isn't there, Angela?
Oh, there certainly is. I mean, I think that's a very important part of it. I think you have to understand that, again, as we heard from Catherine, most Russians on surfing the internet all the time. They are listening to what they see on television, and they get a, like a 360-degree different story than they did were they
completely
watching it in Europe or the United States. And they are, you know, still a profoundly conservative people. And I think this appeal to Russian national pride, overcoming the humiliation of the collapse of the Soviet Union, very few Russians believe that the Soviet Union collapsed because of its own weakness. They believe it was engineered by the United States and its intelligence services. So all of this, what Putin is appealing to is a sense of humiliation and wrong, you know, wrongfulness. And finally, Russia can be proud, and it's reasserting its influence in what is its traditional sphere.
And they may be right, many of those citizens who think the United States intelligence helped engineer, well, of course, perestroika and glasnost can't be just relegated to all of that. But the fact of the matter is, I always remind myself, Putin is a man who struggled with intelligence services because he was the head of one called the KGB. Let me get another caller on here.
And, FSB, and very briefly.
Yeah. Go ahead, Francis. You're on.
Oh, thank you. Really, really interesting conversation. And I'm wondering if your guests, Michael, could talk about BRICS and the New World Bank and how Russians' involvement with that could mitigate any Western sanctions on Russia. And also, you're talking about sort of like the stirrings of a new Cold War, world war. Wondering about, you know, how BRICS might play a role in that.
Certainly plays a role, Catherine Stoner.
Well, you know, the term BRICS was made up by an analyst in London 10 years ago. And, you know, there's very little that, I guess I'm a BRICS doubter. There's very little that these countries actually have in common in terms of how they grew. And now Russia's not growing at all. So with respect to the BRICS Bank, I think this is you know, members of the developing world, transitional economies, Brazil in particular, and India and China doing very well, wanting an alternative to the World Bank and the IMF, and so creating their alternative fund this way. Why Russia is included in this group now, I think, is a big fat question mark, because they are not growing at the same pace. Their growth model is not based on astute policy decisions by Mr. Putin, but almost purely on global oil prices. And if you look at a graph of GDP growth and the price of oil in Russia, you'll see that it pretty much runs in lockstep. And he doesn't control global oil prices. So this
no,
is
but that's a great deal
decision.
Of the leverage that he has, isn't it, Angela Stent? I mean, with respect to the EU and Europe and the West standing up to him?
It's gas.
Sure. I mean, let me reinforce what Catherine said. I mean, there's much less than meets the eye to the whole BRICS process. And essentially what Russia is going to become, and some Russians understand this, is a raw materials appendage for China. I mean, the Chinese just got this great energy deal with the Russians to build a gas pipeline, which they've been negotiating for 10 years. And had to, you know, give in at very low prices for the Chinese. If the Chinese are going to get all other kinds of benefits and owning assets within. So oil prices, Mr. Putin can't control. On the other hand, of course, the more turmoil there is in the world, the higher oil prices are, even though objectively we have, you know, plenty of oil in the world. So in some senses, all of these simultaneous crises that we have going on at the moment in the world are keeping oil prices artificially high, and that's great for Russia.
Let me go to a couple of emails here. And Angela Stent, here's Max, who writes, over 200 NATO citizens were murdered. Russian-backed separatists are clearly responsible. Why is nobody talking about sending NATO forces to assist Ukraine? If 195 Americans were dead rather than 195 Dutch, would this be a different conversation? We have an expansionist fascist state in Putin's Russia. Hillary Clinton had reason to compare Putin to Hitler. Why can no one see how urgent it is to contain Putin?
Is that for me or for Angela?
NATO troops.
Anyone, yeah.
To Ukraine, you know, is Ukraine is not a member of NATO, and that really would be, in a sense, a nuclear option. I mean, not with nuclear weapons, but that would presumably then be even more of an excuse for Russia to invade. So the U.S., I mean, we've basically taken that off the table. I think what we could do, we could send, you know, more arms to the Ukrainians. We could give them more intelligence assistance, which apparently we are doing now. So there are ways that we can work with the Ukrainian military to bolster them, because they're still quite weak and trying to build themselves up. But I think sending NATO troops there would sort of be a declaration of war on Russia.
And Catherine Stoner, here's a listener, Sean, who writes, Russia is clearly an illiberal state, but President Poroshenko and the Fatherland Party, which controls the legislature in Ukraine, are fairly illiberal as well, trying to ban the Communist Party, etc. How does the U.S. and EU justify support for them?
Well, I think that's an overstatement, as was your previous guest's comment about Ukrainian fascists. That's the line that the Ukrainian fascist line, at least, is the line that Russians are receiving on their own television stations and radio stations and in the press there.
There is a neo-Nazism in Ukraine, sure, though, there's no question.
Sure, but there is here in the United States, too. This is a very thin sliver of the Ukrainian population. These guys did terribly in the last rounds of elections, and Poroshenko is certainly not a fascist himself. Yeah. Whether he's some kind of great Democrat, I don't think we can necessarily say that either. But he's who we have to deal with right now. That election was declared free and fair, and so he's the leader we have in place. I just wanted to bolster a couple of things Angela was saying too about, you know, what we can do in terms of supporting Ukraine. I know one thing that we're, of course, Ukraine's not a member of NATO. Would love to be a member of NATO, I think, Russia, but that's very unlikely. What we can do is some of the things that we have been doing, giving them some more technical assistance, also guiding them in terms of bombing, I know is certainly something we've been thinking about. And the third thing is to help Ukraine develop its economy, either by creating some sort of development bank or development fund for Ukraine, but getting Ukraine off dependency. It's 100% dependent on Russian gas, for example, now.
We've come sort of the end of this segment. I've got to ask both of you, you're talking about nuclear options a moment ago. What about Moscow actually launching a full-scale cross-border intervention into Ukraine? Possibility or just too remote and too unlikely?
I mean, it's a possibility, but it's hopefully a very remote possibility. But you can't rule anything out because I think we're now in a situation where it's very hard to predict what Russia's next move will be.
Right. I would agree. It's a remote possibility. I don't think it's impossible, though. And I think the way Russia is going to fight this is a sort of new war, a new approach by having support, basically, for proxies.
Well, we will continue, obviously, to follow what is going on in Ukraine and with respect to Russia. I want to thank our two guests, Catherine Stoner, political scientist and senior fellow with the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford, and Angela Stent, professor of government and director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian and East European Studies at Georgetown and former advisor on Russia to Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and author of The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. Another hour ahead, Michael Ellis will be joining us. We're going to talk about the naturalistic world in the hour ahead and hope you will join us for that. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.